Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with more heated rhetoric from the White House and accusations of alarming ongoing provocations from a country that the Secretary of State just said has the potential to travel the same path as North Korea and take the world along with it. That country, Iran, is the same country which the Trump administration on April the 18th just certified as abiding by the nuclear deal of 2015, the same Obama deal that Trump promised to tear up. Joining us to try to make sense of the flip-flopping and incoherence of Donald Trump's Middle East policy, which is headed up by his son-in-law, who has no government or diplomatic experience other than being in New York real estate, is Mansour Farang, a professor of international relations at Bennington College. He resigned as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendations to release its U.S. hostages. Then, with Attorney General Jeff Sessions poised to revive Nancy Reagan's war on drugs, prioritizing his personal obsession against marijuana over the very real problem of a nationwide opiate addiction scourge, we will speak with Norm Stamper, a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a drug policy advocacy group. The author of To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police, he joins us to discuss Sessions' coming war on legal marijuana. Then finally, we will discuss President Trump's threat to kill the Affordable Care Act by taking away subsidies to insurers as a way to get Democrats to negotiate changes in the 2010 health law. Wendell Potter, who was chief spokesman for Cigna and head of corporate communications at Humana before becoming a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity, joins us in the studio to discuss this cruel and callous tactic designed to make Trump's prediction that Obamacare would explode come true. And joining us now is Mansour Farang, who is a professor of international relations at Bennington College. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its U.S. hostages. His books include U.S. Imperialism, The Spanish-American War to the Iranian Revolution, and The U.S. Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mansour Farang.
Thank you.
And it's very hard to follow the U.S. foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran. And of course, I think the caveat that's necessary is that it's hard to follow U.S. foreign policy in general because we don't really know who's in charge, whether it's the Secretary of State, whether it's the 36-year-old son-in-law of the President Trump, Jared Kushner, or whether it's General McMaster or General Mattis. But there has been some pretty strange zigzags or flip-flops. The Trump administration certified on April the 18th that Iran is indeed following, standing by the nuclear deal, the very deal that Trump vowed to tear up. And now they're going to conduct a 90-day review about whether or not to lift sanctions as required in the deal. So what do you make of it? Because on the one hand, that's going on. And then on top of that, the Secretary of State, Tillerson, castigates Iran, saying that Iran's alarming and ongoing provocations make it the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and unchecked Iran has the potential to travel the same path as North Korea. You know, that's about as heated rhetoric as you can get, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's really hollow rhetoric at the same time, in the sense that what is the policy? There is even some contradiction between the statement made by Secretary of State a couple of days ago and what President Trump said today. It's really, it's very hard to detect a reasonable or achievable, a realistic U.S. policy toward Iran. President Trump says Iran has violated the spirit of the nuclear deal. The reality is that the nuclear deal didn't have anything to do with Iran's foreign policy in the Middle East region. One could criticize Iran on human rights ground, on a variety of perspectives. One could be critical of Iran's foreign policy in the region or elsewhere, but it had nothing to do with the nuclear deal. The nuclear deal is an international agreement. The European Union, the United Nations Security Council, the United States, Germany and all of these countries agreed, and today all European countries, the European Union, as well as the Security Council, are satisfied with Iran's acceptance of its obligations on the basis of the nuclear deal. When President Trump talks about violating the spirit of the deal, he is assuming that the nuclear deal was supposed to change Iran's foreign policy behavior in the region, which had absolutely nothing to do with the understanding of various players in reaching the agreement.
So what do you put it down to then, Mansour Farhang? Is this amateurism, incompetence, or is this some mendacious? Because more often than not, and particularly in the context of what we're discussing, it's hard not to notice that the kind of rhetoric coming out of the White House vis-a-vis Iran sounds like Saudi Arabia's talking points.
There is no question. Both Saudi Arabia and Israel, that is to say, there is a competition between Saudi Arabia and Iran on sectarian ground, and it has been intensified in recent years, but there is nothing new about that. But it's interesting that it is perfectly legitimate to criticize and condemn Iran for human rights violations, but the situation is worse in Saudi Arabia, or with respect to Israeli treatment of Palestinians. So President Trump focusing on human rights situation in Iran is an absurdity in the context of U.S. policy toward a region. My understanding is that President Trump is responding to pressure from Israel, from Netanyahu, and Netanyahu's supporters in the United States, as well as to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has its own problems and Iran has become, in a sense, the kind of enemy that Saudi Arabia can use as justification for the various problems it faces in the region, particularly in Yemen. At the same time, it may well be that focusing on Iran and North Korea, it's helping President Trump with respect to his domestic base in the United States. That is to say, bombing other countries or threatening other countries could always generate a degree of public support in the United States among the right wing in the community and the people who voted for him. And it may well be that his purpose is really to gain some popular support at home and at least satisfy symbolically both Saudi Arabia and Israel. Otherwise, there is no policy, there is no strategic objective in President Trump's attitude toward Iran.
Now, talking about the press, Mansour Farhang, particularly in the context of your book, it's pretty obvious that not only is Donald Trump pandering to his base, he's also discovered the best way to get the press distracted from the Russia story, which is obviously bothering him and may end up leading to his impeachment, that, you throw a few cruise missiles at Syria, you drop this big bomb in Afghanistan that turns out to be not particularly effective, but it grabbed the headlines for a while. And, of course, rumors of war with North Korea, that also generates a lot of headlines. So, to my mind, Donald Trump is a very flagrant and rather pathetic example of the politics of distraction, the politics of stunts. Everything that he does is a stunt. For example, the H-1B1 visa photo op he did the other day in Wisconsin was a pure stunt, as was one of the first things he did where he visited that factory Carrier and saved a couple of jobs from being outsourced to Mexico. So I know I'm being editorial here, but I think it's important to put it in the context of that we've never seen anything like this. So, when you're talking about what's going on, the baseline is pretty low.
Particularly given the fact that during his campaign, he was criticizing the liberals and the Democratic Party for interfering in the internal affairs of other countries. He said, this is not our business. We are not going to tell them how to live their lives and all that. While, as you were just describing, particularly with respect to the Middle East, it's the kind of interference that could generate support for him at home, however marginal that support might be. it will help him. And also, as you said, distraction from the real difficulties he's faced with respect to Congress, the Republican Party, and the Russian issue. But Iran, the problem he has with respect to Iran is that the European countries are all satisfied with Iran's behavior with respect to the nuclear issue. And they are actually, they're trying to normalize Iran's economic and trade, you know, relations. And also Iran has pretty normal relationship with Russia, with China, with Japan, with South Korea. So Iran is engaged in a kind of ideologically or religiously motivated foreign policy behavior toward certain Arab countries, but outside that area, Iran's foreign policy is very conventional, very ordinary. For example, you never hear Iran to say anything in defense of Muslims in Chechnya or Muslims in China, because they don't want to alienate the Chinese or the Russians. Iran has decent relationship with the Asian republics, even with Pakistan. So calling Iran a rogue state is really not an adequate description of reality, except the fact that given the image of Iran, which began this negative image, began with the hostage crisis and Iran's rhetoric and Ahmadinejad's absurd statements to the late night shows in the United States, attacking Iran and accusing Iran and blaming Iran resonates with public opinion in the United States, and he's using it. The same thing is true with respect to North Korea and Syria. So he's using the kind of enemies who have a very negative image in the American public, whether it has any kind of policy implication seems to be irrelevant for Mr. Trump.
Right, but it's, maybe that he's pandering to his base, but as far as I know, his base is shrinking. I don't see the value, ultimately, of pandering to the isolationist and America first and xenophobic and ignorant kind of base, as opposed to the reality of the rest of the world, and particularly those who follow foreign policy. It's hard not to notice, for example, the absolute inconsistency here, that right. Here you are beating up on Iran over human rights, and you call up and congratulate Erdogan, who just stole an election. He probably lost that election narrowly, and now he's claiming a narrow victory. It was fraud-ridden. The EU have said it's completely fraud-ridden. There wasn't a level playing field. So Trump blithely, absolutely undercuts half of the population of Turkey, who are mad as hell, who are the educated half, the urban half. He alienates them by calling up Erdogan and congratulating him. And he did the same thing prior to that with inviting Sisi, the dictator in Egypt, to the White House and calling him all kinds of wonderful things, while this guy's got about 50,000 political prisoners in jail that he's torturing. I mean,
exactly.
It's crazy.
He seems to identify with strongmen, with dictators, with Sisi of Egypt, with Putin, with Erdogan. And also he has economic interest in Turkey. That protection of his economic interest is definitely part of his motive. So it's really true. Trump has been described by some scholars as a postmodern president, and a postmodernist believes, among other things, that there is no truth. There is no truth, and the truth can change from day to day in order to serve immediate purpose. And as time goes on, it's narcissism, and that fundamentally governs the policy. He has no strategic perspective toward the Middle East and the people surrounding him, to what extent they influence him with respect to long-term foreign policy, remains to be seen. His son-in-law is not very informed, is not really the kind of strategic thinker who could set up foreign policy priorities. So every day he says something different. So as someone who doesn't believe in the kind of lies that pleases people, the kind of factions that sound good to the people, he could repeat them and change them, as we have seen it in the past year or so. So it's very hard to use regular logic, issues of consistency, in order to evaluate what he's talking about. He's really in a very different universe than logic would allow us to understand him.
Well, there's always been, to some extent, a kind of symbiosis between the hawks on our side and whatever country we're having a squabble with or a confrontation with. And, for example, the more you confront North Korea, the better it is for Kim Jong-un. And the same would be true for Ayatollah Khamenei and the IRGC. And there are elections coming up in Iran next month, and the current president, Hassan Rouhani, is not exactly in the strongest position. So could this saber-rattling lead to helping elect an even more hardline regime in Iran?
No question. In fact, you know, the invasion of Iraq was a gift given to Iran. And all the people who came to rule Iraq, they had lived in Iran for 20 years. Ahmad Chalabi, who received $20 million a year from the Congress of the United States to be active against Saddam Hussein, he was operating in Iran, and he was actually paying some of that money to Iran's Revolutionary Guards to train the Al-Bad Brigade, the Iraqi political, the Iraqi prisoners, or the Iraqi volunteers who had gone to Iran. So it's very interesting. There seems to be a convergence of interest between right-wing elements in Washington and right-wing elements in Iran. They have definitely benefited from each other's position. In Iran today, there is no democratic election in Iran. There is a competitive election within the regime, and there is a real factional division within the regime. People who see this type of confrontation to be a threat to the stability of the regime, and there are others who want to pursue a more radical and ideological line in the foreign policy. Trump's position, Trump's attitude toward Iran can only help the most radical, the most hardline elements within the regime, and weaken the people who try to moderate their position, their foreign policy position, which Rouhani and Zarif have been trying to do to some extent, and they do have the support of significant sectors of the population. But this type of confrontation between the United States and Iran can only help the hardliners, not only to continue the radical hardline foreign policy, but also use the threat of enemy to even greater suppress dissident and critics of the regime within the country.
But when you point out, and quite accurately, of course, that the invasion of Iraq was a huge gift to Iran, Iran is the only winner of the Iraq war, I'm not sure that the neocons and Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld and Rice and et al. And Bremer, the whole sorry crowd who got us into that catastrophe, based on lies, I might add, were doing it out of any great strategic thinking. It seemed to be coming out of arrogance and ignorance, and that's the same motive, it seems, to be driving what we're talking about now vis-a-vis Iran. I don't see any great strategic designs here. It just seems like gross ignorance and gross incompetence.
Exactly. The neocons, like other imperialists throughout history, they think the destructive power they have would enable them to get what they want. And of course, they can destroy. There is no question about that. The kind of destruction, over 500,000 Iraqis were killed by the time the United States was finished with Iraq. And yet, destructive power is not very useful when you want to create a new government, when you want to create coalition of competing forces in the country. Here, it is really the arrogance of power and this the pathological view that the destructive power could enable the United States or any other big power to achieve what they want. They didn't learn it in Vietnam, just as they should have learned from the Russian experience in Afghanistan, and they didn't, and they committed exactly the same mistake in Iraq. But that arrogance of power, which was very much part of the neoconservative movements, it was the really the root of this incredible tragedy that has been happening in the Middle East, and they haven't really. There doesn't seem to be a change. There is change in rhetoric, but there doesn't seem to be a change in the arrogance of power and the claim that the destructive power, the bombing of other countries, would enable the United States to get what it wants.
Well, just in closing, there are rumors that the United States is deploying military equipment in the Gulf. We also know that Eric Prince, the brother of the new education secretary, who has mercenary army there in the Gulf, is involved with Bannon and the Trump administration. And we also know that Mattis has got some obsession about Iran, as does, I don't know about McMaster, but certainly Tillerson has just come out with this ridiculous charges. So something's going on there. And one of the rumors that I've heard from the JSOC sources is that they are planning on an incident in the Gulf, which Eric Prince would be capable of creating, which could start a shooting war with Iran. So as crazy as that sounds, do you think there is a possibility at the end of the day that we're dealing with something more than saber rattling and rhetoric here?
It may well be that even an accident in the Persian Gulf could result in war. It is possible for the United States to bomb, for example, the refineries of Iran or the various military or industrial bases in the country, but by doing that, they can only strengthen the radical elements in Iran. It would be a disaster for the Iranian people. But if the United States really wants to change the Iranian regime, then they have to send over 1 million troops and let them be there and fight people on the streets for unlimited number of years. So yes, a military action could take place, but the military action itself is not going to produce the kind of result that American politicians are promising us.
Well, Mansour Farang, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mansour Farang, who's a professor of international relations at Bennington College. He resigned from his post as Revolutionary Iran's first ambassador to the United Nations when Khomeini's regime refused to accept the UN's recommendation to release its US hostages. His books include US Imperialism, The Spanish Civil War to the Iranian Revolution, and The US Press in Iran, Foreign Policy and the Journalism of Deference. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Attorney General Jeff Sessions' coming war on legal marijuana. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Norm Stamper, who's a retired Seattle police chief and an advisory board member of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a drug policy advocacy group. And his latest book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norm Stamper.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Thanks, Norman. It does seem that the Attorney General, the number one law enforcement officer in the land, is something of a throwback. He seems to be obsessed with marijuana, and nobody's ever died of a marijuana overdose. And there are 29 states in the United States that have legalized medical marijuana, and 8 states, including the District of Columbia, allow recreational use, and 61% of Americans support legalization. So I don't understand. Is this a personal obsession of Sessions, or is he really going to reorient and revive the war on drugs with a focus on marijuana?
You know, it's probably both. and I'm guessing fueled by the former, that it's a personal obsession. He's taken to quoting Nancy Reagan and her Just Say No campaign, and he is essentially pining for the 80s and 90s at the peak of the drug war. And I think we've all pretty much as a country recognized the folly of that drug war and the damage that it's done. So it's a retrograde position that he's taken, and he needs to be resisted. The administration needs to be held to account for sane and sensible drug policy, and this is neither.
And what's the is there a connection with the Representative Tom Marino, who has been selected to head the Office of National Drug Control Policy? Obviously, it has to be confirmed by the Senate, but nevertheless, he's a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania. What do we know about him? In other words, is he going to carry out these policies that Sessions appears to be advocating?
Well, you can be certain that he's going to carry out those policies, because just as Sessions is beholden to Trump, Marino will be beholden to Sessions. They're all part of the same administration. And although Trump has said, I think we should leave marijuana policy to the states on several occasions in the past, we can only hope that he hasn't had a change of heart on that issue. Marino is an unreconstituted drug warrior. He believes in continuing a policy of classifying marijuana with heroin and crack cocaine and a variety of other drugs, which means that if he has his way and if Congress supports this administration, we will see a throwback to an earlier and uglier chapter of American drug history.
So my understanding is that we've spent something like $1.5 trillion on the war on drugs, and it's pretty hard not to make it clear that it has been less than successful, particularly if you focus on marijuana, when in fact so many deaths, as I mentioned, nobody's died of a marijuana overdose, but people are dropping dead right, left and center. There's an opioid epidemic in the country. Rock stars like Prince die from fentanyl, which is apparently fairly available. And there's so much prescription drugs, Oxycontin, for example, out there that's created addicts, and then they've had to turn to heroin because it's hard to get prescription drugs in the volume that they wanted. And then on top of that, you've got fentanyl out there that's 100 times more potent. So it's almost like Sessions is operating in an alternative universe. There are some serious problems out there with opioid addiction. We hear a lot about it. But if you're going to go after marijuana and not even talk about the opioid epidemic, it's almost like we're in an alternative universe.
I think that's a pretty good way to characterize it. The drug war, which has focused an enormous amount of time, attention, and money on marijuana laws, has been a colossal failure. And now we're talking about, in effect, re-engineering it, pumping even additional resources into it. It does make one wonder whether these folks are reading the research, or whether the research even means anything to them that would cause them to avail themselves of it. We know that prohibition of marijuana has led to violence, because if you're dealing with an illicit substance, you can't really tax and control and regulate that. But if marijuana were legal, and I predict that it will be very soon, comparatively soon, probably a more accurate way to put it, throughout all 50 states, the American people are apparently doing their homework. We need our elected officials to do the same, of course. But in the final analysis, spending $1.5 trillion to prosecute the drug war that results in greater availability of these drugs at lower prices and higher levels of potency is utter nonsense. We're making our country more dangerous, not less, in doing that.
But it would seem to me that if big drug manufacturers are making OxyContin, for example, and it's people are dying of overdoses right, left, and center, and of abusing this drug, that would be the most identifiable target of all, wouldn't it? The drug company itself and the doctors that prescribe it. You don't need to have drug stings and go underground. It's there right in our face, isn't it?
Well, that's one of the more puzzling aspects of current U.S. drug policy for exactly that reason. We're talking about drugs that are readily available and in prescription form, legitimately available if a doctor prescribes them for whatever value that product may have on a particular patient's case. And it's not an underground market. So it does, I think, really argue for major reforms on the prescription drug front. But marijuana has until very recently, of course, never been legal. It has always been illicit, and its enforcement has always caused much greater harm than good.
Well, again, there is a real epidemic out there, and it does seem that if you make that argument that marijuana is a gateway drug to heroin, which has never been proven, you can surely make the argument that prescription drugs like OxyContin are gateway drugs to heroin, because when you can't get the prescription any longer, you turn to heroin. The evidence is overwhelming, and yet we do hear a lot about this epidemic, and it's become a political issue. And yet I don't see any focus on it. I mean, are we just to assume that, as we started out this conversation, Norm Stamper, that this is some peculiar obsession that Sessions has about marijuana? Because remember, he was U.S. attorney in Alabama in the 1980s, and he famously said that, "I thought the Ku Klux Klan were okay until I found out they smoke pot." And in April of this year, he said, "Good people don't smoke marijuana." And then he made that recent TV appearance where he just says, "I don't know whether legalizing marijuana is a good idea. How can it be a good thing?" So, again, I know I'm floundering here, but I wanted to get a handle from you on a reality check on ginning up a phony problem that is largely being solved by the American people. And is this happening at the expense of ignoring the real problem, which is the opioid epidemic?
Well, I believe it is. And let's understand that whether we're talking about marijuana or opioids, we are talking about current U.S. drug laws, which prohibit possession of either of those classes of psychotropic substances. So what you've got is a situation currently where the federal government has said marijuana, as well as all these other drugs, is illegal. You cannot possess it. You cannot trade in its commerce. You cannot legally be in possession of marijuana in this country as a function of federal law. So the states have taken the lead. The people in those states, most of these through initiative, have taken the lead. And there is a considerable amount of research available to anyone who wants to read it and avail themselves of it. There are experts from coast to coast and border to border who could provide education to Mr. Sessions, because I don't mean to be unkind, but he's clearly in need of accurate information, and he lacks it.
But as the Attorney General of the United States, with all that power that he has at his disposal, can he turn back the clock and prosecute marijuana as a federal offense, which it still is, and go against the will of these 29 states?
Yeah, the short answer is, yeah, of course, he can do that. He has the leverage of federal law, which trumps local and state laws. So in theory, yes, he could do that. The question is whether or not he would be willing to, in effect, violate the will of the people, take actions that are contraindicated in the science. He could, in fact, say, "I'm going to use the federal government's law enforcement agencies to come after marijuana." That would be, of course, a disastrous public policy position for the Trump administration, because you'd be taking police officers away from robberies and burglaries and car prowls and auto thefts and rape and domestic violence and all sorts of crimes that scare people and hurt them and cause them to change the way they live. And so it would be, I think, the height of foolishness for Sessions to do just that.
But if we're to look at what he has said and the position she's taken, it's pretty hard to avoid the conclusion that this is, if not his top priority, it's one of his top priorities.
It appears that way to me as well. And I, you know, I don't know what more can be said about his failure to grasp just how wrongheaded that position is. But, you know, I keep my fingers crossed and make my statements and hope that others join in the effort to resist that kind of a trend, because it's a very, very unhealthy one.
Well, just in closing, Norm Stamper, Attorney General Sessions was down on the border the other day making a statement about illegal immigration, and I watched the video of it, and I'm surprised that nobody much picked up on this in the press. When he was walking by the border there, he had a sidearm, like a 9mm. I mean, have you ever seen an Attorney General of the United States in a suit wearing a sidearm?
Never. And it's indicative, I think, of a cowboy mentality. He is attempting, I think, to add to the optics that border is dangerous. And certainly, we have seen violence along the border, just as we've seen violence in cities across the country. But I've never seen an attorney general openly packing.
Well, Norm Stamper, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Norm Stamper, who's a retired Seattle police chief and advisory board member of Law Enforcement Action Partnership, a drug policy advocacy group. His latest book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Trump's threat to kill the Affordable Care Act by taking away subsidies to insurers. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now in the studio is Wendell Potter, the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving America. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and as head of corporate communications at Humana, he's now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Thank you, Ian.
So it looks as if Donald Trump has the option of sabotaging Obamacare. And judging by a meeting that took place on Tuesday in the White House, where Seema Verner, the new Medicare administrator, met with the top insurance company executives, it doesn't look as though, you know, the health insurers wanted to keep the subsidies, and they made a case for keeping the subsidies under Obamacare, but they didn't get any assurances from the administration. So is that what's going to happen?
Well, it's hard to say, but because they didn't get those assurances, I am concerned about what will happen to the exchanges. The insurance companies don't like uncertainty, and that's what they've got right now is uncertainty. And they have to make decisions in the coming weeks as to whether or not they will participate in the exchanges in 2018, and if so, how they'll price their products. And it makes a big difference knowing whether or not those substances will be available or not.
Well, already Aetna and United Health have dropped out of the market, leaving Anthem Blue Cross. And it wouldn't take much to collapse it, would it? I mean, is it hanging by a thread, do you think?
Well, it is not unless the Trump administration decides to cut the thread that it's hanging by. It's not such a slim thread, but the Trump administration can really do a great deal of damage by just not moving forward with this or acknowledging that the substances will be there or not. The two companies you mentioned, Aetna and United, are big for-profit insurance companies. So is Anthem, for that matter. But Anthem is composed of a lot of Blue Cross plans around the country that were initially nonprofit health insurance companies that have operated in the individual market for many years. It's been a big part of their business. The individual market has never been a big part of Aetna's or United's book of business. They didn't have as much experience working in those markets and making a profit. So it didn't surprise me that they left. So did Humana for the most part, and Cigna's not doing very much. All those are the big for-profit insurance companies.
So I don't see Trump starting this again. He says he's going to come back to the House, and he says he's going to do something great again. He keeps saying that about everything, and nothing seems to happen. There's actually been no legislation. He's coming up on his first 100 days. This is truly the most incompetent, ridiculous administration I've ever seen, and I don't see it getting any better, and I don't see how he can, he and Paul Ryan can reconcile the vulnerable Republicans who don't want to throw people into the street and take away the health care and suffer the political backlash, and this handful of, you know, Freedom Caucus, Tea Party ideologues, right, who just are driven by ideology.
That's exactly right. They're in a dilemma, and there is no way out of this dilemma in a way that really works for the party or certainly works for the American people. And if the administration does pull the subsidies, the individual market really will be in a difficult situation. It will mean that there will be some insurance companies that stay in the marketplace, but if those subsidies are not available to individuals who are looking to buy coverage, they just simply can't afford it. It doesn't make sense to them.
And again, I'm speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and as head of corporate communications at Humana Inc., he is now senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. And his latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Will Do About It. It's hard to keep up with the mendacity of what's going on with the Trump administration. And frankly, as much as he's the wrecking crew and he's totally out of his depth and he's obviously dangerous and incompetent and ignorant and arrogant, I mean, I can go on. But I also think that in many ways, the sober one, the reassuring one, Mike Pence, he's sort of in many ways even worse because he's the guy that basically looks like the deal was made. You get the Christian right votes and I get the vice presidency. I deal with the Congress. I get so many cabinet positions, Betsy DeVos. I get the Koch brothers, people putting their guy in at EPA, etc. So if somehow this Trump is impeached or the incompetence just gets too great, that there has to be some kind of intervention. Are we going to be any better off with?
I think your concern here, you've got to be careful what you wish for, right, quite frankly. And you're right. Trump is not an ideologue. He's an opportunist, in my view. And we're seeing already that he will change his point of view and his position on a whim, whatever seems to suit him. And so he's not driven by ideology by any means. He's been a Democrat, he's been a Republican, he's been an independent, and he goes back and forth. So we just don't know what he's going to do next. With Pence, you know you've got a right-wing ideologue, and I don't know which would be worse for this country, to tell you the truth.
But how does the Christian part gel with so much of what he's doing in terms of, you know, destroying the health of the nation? I mean, it doesn't make sense. Any cursory reading of the Bible would indicate that the prophet Jesus ministered to the poor and was all about charity and goodness and forgiveness. You know, it's not about this kind of cruel idea because of some abstraction known as the deficit, which, by the way, they'll blow out of all proportion if judging by what they're talking about in terms of their so-called tax reform package. So do you have any understanding of how they can? I wanted to bring up this, and maybe this is the moment to do it. The thing that really alarmed me was I just learned recently that the new head of the FDA, and again, I don't know whether he's a part of the deal, who put him in there, but he apparently is going to get rid of the FDA's obligation to test drugs. And the FDA has two standards on drugs. Are they safe and are they effective?
Yeah.
Safe, of course, obviously means they can't poison you and they can't have terrible side effects. Effective means they actually work. Apparently, 9 out of 10 drugs submitted by the pharmaceutical, by Big Pharma, don't work. Nine out of 10.
Exactly right.
And the FDA rejects them. Right. Well, now they won't be rejecting them because guess what? The Trump administration is going to have the industry police itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the American people will be getting worse than placebos.
Oh,
9 out of 10 of the drugs they'll be on the marketplace will be absolutely useless.
It's a very scary thing. I know the guy you're talking about, Scott Gottlieb.
You know him?
I do know him, and I've known him have met him in years past. When I was working in the insurance industry, he was someone that the insurance industry felt was a very good friend and was a reliable colleague and someone who could come to the industry's defense when necessary. He has written often for the Wall Street Journal, so he was someone that the industry turned to if you needed something in the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. So he's doing this. He's playing the same role, I think, for the pharmaceutical industry here as he has in the past. It's very troubling. And you're exactly right. A lot of the drugs that are proposed to the FDA are not safe. Even those that do get past the FDA's testing and scrutiny often do more harm than good. Many of them are pulled from the market for good reason, and it's really scary. There's a book, by the way, that I would encourage people to look for. It's written by an attorney friend of mine. It's called Pharmageddon, and it is precisely on this topic about how the pharmaceutical industry gets away with, frankly, getting away with murder with a lot of the drugs that they bring to market.
But the other standard is, are they effective? And apparently that's being thrown out the window because 9 out of 10 of them aren't effective. So Imagine what it's going to be like now. It's almost as if the pharmaceutical industry now underwrites television because most of the ads on television are from a Big Pharma.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Are they going to be adding enough? They're going to be giving 10 times more ads?
How could they possibly do that?
Right.
they only airway so much already. And as you probably know, we're only one of two countries in the world that allows that kind of advertising, the other being New Zealand, and for good reason. It just contributes to the waste in our healthcare system, the enormous amount of money that's spent in ways that do not do anything to improve care.
So what do you think can be done to stop Trump from sabotaging Obamacare?
I don't know that there is anything that can be done. The Democrats don't have a lot of leverage in the in either House of Congress, either chamber. I think that possibly what people are doing already, showing up at town hall meetings, protesting, asking sharp questions of lawmakers. We're seeing that on TV and hearing about it, reading about it. They're doing a very good job. The public is really waking up now that the Affordable Care Act, now that Obamacare is under threat and there is the possibility that it can be undone, they're paying more attention to what's going on. I think that if we see more of that, you're going to see a lot more lawmakers reluctant to do as they have said they would do in the past, which is repeal it. That said, as we were talking earlier, it can be sabotaged by the Trump administration essentially doing nothing.
So what then is the clout or the, I guess, the purpose and direction of big insurance? We talked about Big Pharma and how they're going to be given a gift by Trump to dump a bunch of worthless drugs on the market. But as we started out, you know, the meeting that took place in the White House on Tuesday with Seema Verma, the new Medicare administrator, where she met with health insurers, and they pressed the Trump administration about these billions of dollars in subsidies that are for low-income people to buy plans under the federal health care law, the Affordable Care Act. But they left empty-handed. There's no assurances. What kind of clout do they have?
Well, the insurance industry doesn't have a lot of clout, nor do they really care all that much about, frankly, what happens to the Affordable Care Act. And here's why. For the most part, the insurance companies are doing quite well. They don't make a lot of money and never have made a lot of money on the individual market, which is really what we're talking about. It's the ability of people who don't get coverage, or it's the place where people who can go who don't get coverage to the workplace or not eligible for Medicare or Medicaid or some other public program. The insurance industry, most insurers don't care for that market. And most of the companies that you named a few minutes ago, United and Aetna and I mentioned Humana and Cigna, they're big for-profit companies, and their main interest is enhancing shareholder value, is making a profit margin that Wall Street's financial analysts expect. And they couldn't care less about the individual market. If it collapses, so be it. They're making actually more money from the government through the Medicare and Medicaid program. Most people don't really understand that, but a lot of states have turned their Medicaid programs over to big insurance companies. The insurance companies are in the Medicare Advantage business. In other words, they're attracting a lot of people into these private Medicare replacement plans. They're making money hand over fist doing that. So they don't care about the individual market. They couldn't care less.
Well, we were mentioning earlier, and at least I was, that I thought that in many ways this genial, good Christian fellow, Mike Pence, might even be worse than Trump because he's an ideologue and an aggressively devout Christian who wants to get rid of the Johnson Amendment, for example, so that these televangelists on television can recommend who you should vote for openly. They do it covertly at any rate.
So right.
Maybe that's not much of a difference. But the other fellow that gets a free pass and is considered some kind of intellectual and policy wonk is Paul Ryan. And he's just an absolute zealous ideologue.
Yes.
He wanted to get rid of he wants to get rid of Medicaid. So that was the last thing he came up with in the Ryan plan that didn't go very far to repeal and replace Obamacare. That's the subtext for that. Now in his tax reform package, the subtext is to get rid of Social Security by repealing the payroll tax and handing it to the middle class as a gift, you know, like a Trojan horse. This is your gift. We give you a tax cut. And, of course, at the expense of not just Social Security, but also some of that payroll tax goes to Medicaid. So, again, you have these aggressive ideologues trying to rip out what little of the social safety net this country has. It's
right.
How is it happening without people up in arms? I mean, I'm astounded at how so much of their mendacity goes under the radar when it should be obvious.
Well, I think two reasons. One is that they're incredibly adept at messaging, at building Trojan horses and getting people to think that they are getting something or being, what's being proposed would be to their advantage. People buy that because of the way they package the selling points. The other is that our media is not doing an adequate job generally of exposing what's really going on. It's why, frankly, I'm creating my own media organization called Tarbell, tarbell.org, to do exactly what we're talking about, to pull the curtains back to reveal what's really going on in Washington, the state capitals, and in the corporate boardrooms. There's very, very little reporting that does exactly what I'm talking about, exposing this stuff that we're talking about and explaining what's in it for the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies as they try to manipulate public opinion and public policy and elections.
And, of course, Ida Tarbell was the famous journalist during the muckraker period
right.
who somehow was able to get inside the boardroom of the Rockefellers.
Right.
And eventually gave the information to Teddy Roosevelt to break up the trusts. And
exactly.
She worked along with Mark Twain.
She was one of the most important journalists in American history because she did exactly as you described. And her reporting led to the breakup of Rockefeller Standard Oil Company and to very important antitrust and campaign finance laws.
So how's your enterprise going then?
It's going very well. We are raising money. We're doing well in our planning. We've got a landing page where people can see what we're all about, and that's tarbell.org. It's a nonprofit organization. So we'll be receiving contributions that are tax deductible. It's going to be reader funded. We will be doing a crowdfunding campaign later in the summer, and we will be producing journalism in the fall.
So it would seem to be a good time because you've got a whole bunch of seasoned journalists being downsized.
Yes.
As the newspaper business and TV loses viewers and newspapers lose readers. It seems like the time is right to put a lot of that deep talent to work.
Absolutely.
To do fact-checking and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, I noticed that, did you catch the story in the New York Times about what Steve Ballmer is trying to do? Just explain that briefly to the public.
What he's undertaking is going to be an extraordinarily important resource to journalists and to the public of taking data and explaining where tax revenues go, how states and the federal government and even municipalities spend their revenues. So you'll be able to follow the money to a certain extent. That's what we'll be doing at Tarbelt also, using that kind of data, but also following where the campaign contributions come from and where they go and what the impact is. But what Ballmer's doing will enable us to see, for example, how much of revenue that's taken in is that cities are having to spend to give state workers and city workers health insurance benefits. One of the things I think that can help reveal and be really meaningful is just how much we are having to spend and how much of that money goes into the treasuries of the big insurance companies that really cannot control healthcare costs. But we've got a system in which the insurance companies are really running the show here. So that will enable us to really get a good picture of how our public officials are spending money and where it's going. A lot of money is going, like I said, into the pockets of insurance company executives when we'd be better off if it could go to infrastructure and education and other things like that.
So this is a roadmap of the real DNA of the government, right?
It really can be. And journalists who can take that information and use data visualization to really paint the picture, it can be a huge service to the public.
Well, I thank you for dropping by the studio, Wendell Potter.
My pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me back on.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who's the author of Deadly Spin, an insurance company insider speaks out on how corporate PR is killing healthcare and deceiving Americans. After a long career in the for-profit health industry as chief corporate spokesman at Cigna and as head of corporate communications at Humana, he's now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. And he's forming a new investigative journalism outfit called Tarbell.org. Tarbell, that's TARBELL.org. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.
One more light goes out in the middle.